Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another great episode we have here of Crime and Science Radio, hosted by DP Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's show is called Judging Science, Evidence and Courts, with very special guest, former prosecutor Marcia Clark, will be here on the show today with Jan Burke. So now, without any further ado, I would like to introduce you to your host, Jan Burke.
Well, thank you, John, and welcome everybody to today's show, and especially welcome to you, Marcia. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jan. Always a pleasure.
So today we're going to talk about your experiences as an attorney and your books, and we're also going to talk about the perceptions and misconceptions people have about the law and evidence and forensic science in the courtroom. So I'm really looking forward to talking about this. And just to start off, you know, how old were you when you decided to become an attorney?
Let's see. I did not start out to be one. I took poli sci as an undergrad and then discovered after graduating that the degree was basically worthless. So
hey,
I had to regroup.
I majored in the lucrative field of history. I understand.
So you see, I mean, it's kind of like in poli sci, I thought I was going to work in the State Department, and that's what I in the Foreign Office, and that's what I wanted to do. And I thought that because I spoke languages, they might actually think that was useful. But they asked me if I could type. So they really don't like girls.
No, they do their best, huh?
Well, you know, a woman who's actually working in the State Department now told me they still don't like girls, so that's kind of interesting and not so fun. But I had to think of what to do, and so that was being, I floated around for a year or two, and then I wound up saying, you know, I think lawyer, I think that works, and like applied at the last minute to law school, took the LSAT, like hungover. I wasn't exactly your most devoted fan of the law, but I became one.
Yeah. So you weren't one of these people who just, you know, in second grade were saying objection to your teacher or something.
I said all kinds of things to my teachers, but that wasn't one of them. That would have been a nicer one. I spent a lot of time thrown outside the classroom, but that's a story for another day, Jan. But when I was a kid, I wanted to write. I loved writing, and I loved acting. That was one of the two things when I was really young that I wanted to do. And I didn't have faith in my ability to earn a living at either one of them. That's
possible.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I see we both did the same kind of thing. We wanted to write. We went into these fields like poli sci and history, and then eventually found our way home.
Because we forced ourselves to, right? After
right,
you discovered
exactly.
History was not really exactly the place to be.
Well, you know, I don't know if you, how you felt about poli sci, but I loved history. I mean, it was something that was unlikely to support me, and it kind of cracks me up now that I rejected trying to write because I wasn't going to earn a living at that, but then I became a history major, so, you know, put that together. But so you, which law school did you go to?
Southwestern, here in Los Angeles.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Oh, great. And you ended up working in defense.
I started as a criminal defense attorney. No way I was going to work for the man. So the thought of being a prosecutor never entered my head. And I clerked for a defense firm for about 2 years, and then I worked as an associate for about a year and a half, and then realized when I was really defending, when it came to the point of defending violent criminals, I realized, you know, I think I'd rather prosecute. In fact, I don't think I need to practice law anymore unless I'm a prosecutor. And so when I went for my interview with the DA then was John Vandekamp, I said, basically, your decision today will determine whether or not I practice law, because I think I'm done if I can't do this.
Wow.
The rest is history.
So what are you've worked in this field, and then you created Rachel Knight, who is the protagonist, well, first Guilt by Association, then Guilty by Degrees. Did I have that right? Guilt by Degrees. And then now Killer Ambition.
Mm-hmm.
So what, in what ways does the real life of a DA differ from what, you know, say, before you're creating this character on your own, we'll get to her in a moment, but from what you're seeing before you wrote your own book about this world, what are some of the differences between real life and what people see on books and on the screen?
What, let's see, I can... One thing for sure that we all cut out, and that includes me, is the boring parts. You know, writing motions, doing research, you know, I don't know how you depict that and make it exciting.
Mm-hmm,
the reading,
mm-hmm.
She's still reading. Typing,
mm-hmm.
She's still typing. You know, there's just no way. So you got to cut that part out. You know, and all of the kind of necessary but boring routine stuff, returning phone calls, court appearances where you just continue and send, you know, put another date, put a case over for another date, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That all that stuff I usually encapsulate in one sentence, if that, or two sentences. So, you know, you get very short shrift of the business of daily life that really does happen to all of us. But she's out in the field more. That means I put her out in the field more than a DA would be, even in special trials. And here's the thing. In special trials, we basically picked up the case the day the body was found. So that meant we were out on the streets with the cops, detectives, a lot. We'd go out.
Mm-hmm.
And I went out and interviewed all of my witnesses on every case. I never, ever took a case to trial without talking to the witnesses personally, and usually outside where they were. Especially at crime scenes, if I could, to let them walk me through, show me what they saw, where they saw it from. It puts you in a better position in court to know what you're talking about.
That is a whole different level of context that I'm imagining. Okay, we're talking about the special trials unit for the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm assuming this isn't something that every jurisdiction has going.
Or every prosecutor in Los Angeles. The thing unique about special trials is that we do that kind of vertical prosecution from the bottom up. And so there is the time, and that's the point of it, because they handle all the high-profile complex cases. They have to have the time to really devote like that, to go out in the field and, you know, and meet with the experts and do all that stuff. Most prosecutors get the case, you know, very shortly before trial, and they read the file on the way to picking a jury. You know, I mean, that's just the pressures that are most common. Other jurisdictions do it differently. I've heard that New York actually does have, as a matter of routine, has the prosecutors out in the field going out there with the detectives. I don't know if that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But every office does it a little differently. I would imagine that in the bigger offices where there's more crime, you have less opportunity to do that. It requires an office with an awful lot of prosecutors to be able to afford to have a special unit devoted to this kind of prosecution. And the DA's office in Los Angeles is the biggest one in the world.
So I didn't know that. Wow. Well, it makes sense. The county's huge. I read once that if it were a state, it'd be the seventh largest state in the United States. So that makes sense. So if in this case, then, for special trials unit, they're working differently than most of the DAs in the office are working.
Right.
They're taking it, I'm assuming then this is mostly high-profile stuff and they're getting called out, or something that's, what would make a special trial, I should ask?
You know, high-profile cases, the kind that are going to attract a lot of media, tends to be like the Menendez brothers. That was a special trials case. Phil Jackson case.
Mm-hmm.
Phil Spector.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Phil Jackson.
Phil Spector.
Oh, my God. Lawsuit. Phil Spector.
Laker fans are going to be calling in. But no.
I'm in trouble.
No. Couldn't find two more different individuals either.
Right? Talk about Alpha and Omega. Anyway, yeah. That's the kind of thing that is special trials case.
Yeah. So we all have seen, you know, everything from L.A. Law onto Law and Order, and you know, it seems like every season there's some new set of legal dramas. And, of course, there are lots of legal thrillers out there in on the page as well. So if you were to name the top 10 things that are errors and cliches in those thrillers and dramas, the ones that really make you go nuts when you see them on the screen, or you know, everyone else in the room is watching something and they're intensely involved in something serious and you're laughing out loud. I ruin certain shows on television for my husband by
I can picture it.
Snorting, you know, like, right, sure.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. Well, you know what? You and I have actually laughed about the forensic stuff that they'll do, where I have found the eyelash in the field that can be typed to no other, you know, out there in the field of alfalfa, you found an eyelash. That's amazing.
Yes.
But, you know, the objections. They have lawyers standing and arguing to the judge in front of the jury about what piece of evidence should and should not come in, you know, and they're basically arguing their whole case. You know, a judge would actually, you know, they demand that you go to sidebar and all that stuff, and you don't get to do that. They have them strutting around the courtroom a lot. Most judges don't let you mess around with the witnesses the way you see them, you know. But,
mm-hmm.
of course, as we know, some judges do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's rare, though.
Yeah. It also seems to me, too, that there's a certain level of showmanship sometimes. That for the sake of drama,
mm-hmm.
you'll have an attorney doing in a trial that on television that in real life a judge would say, settle down.
Yeah, knock
Ms.
it off.
Burke, you know.
Or rulings. The judge rules on stuff in TV land that I wish in my wildest dreams I could get in. You know, stuff that you say, well, he told me that, objection, hearsay, overruled, what?
I was told once by someone who is a writer on Law and Order that he was horrified when real lawyers would call the office wanting to know the case law that they had cited in
Are
the
you
show
kidding?
And having to say, it's a television
show.
Show,
you dimwit.
The reason you couldn't find that on LexisNexis.
Oh, my God, I love that so much. It just tickled me.
Yeah.
Yes, I can relate to those lawyers only because you wish it could go like that.
Yeah.
You get
in
basically everything you need to get. That's fantastic.
So one of the things that I've noticed with both the forensic science shows and with the courtroom dramas is the amazing amount of science that is not past any rule of evidence I know about that gets in. And so maybe we just, I don't even know if most people are aware that there is something called the rules of evidence. So
yes.
Sort of what is that, just for the listeners that have no idea what I'm talking about?
If you're talking about the Dilbert rule and Fry, Kelly Fry.
Dilbert
like
and Fry, and just I mean, even, and I guess even beyond that, there are rules about how, what can come in and, you know, what you can do with an arrestee and so on.
Oh, yeah.
That,
oh, yeah. Oh,
you know. That
no, you really
often
don't.
On,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
You really
it's a
don't
sort of no holds
in
bars situation,
yeah.
You know.
Right.
In
you don't
lobbies.
Get to beat them with phone books.
Yeah.
No, that always cracks me up, where they have cops out there knocking somebody around, and you know, and everybody's turning a blind eye, and they're getting a statement to which they will testify later in court, and it's going to completely nail him, and it'll be fine. And you know, that is the anomaly. Cops, by and large, do not do things like that, and they don't get away with them if they do. And so that's one thing. I mean, you have to read them their rights. You have to get a valid waiver. You can't get the statement in without it. And even once you get the statement, the funniest thing to me is the way statements come in so nice and clean when you have them on television, and the guy either admits it or completely denies it. Okay, but lots of times what you get from a – most of the time when you get from a confession is a yes, but. It's an approach avoidance. So he'll say, well, I did this, but I didn't do that, which is why frequently the best thing you can do, prosecutorially speaking, is don't use it. Don't use the statement. This is his excuse for what he did. And now, unless you think you can't prove it without it, don't bother with it. So they don't show that realistically, and I think that actually might make for a better story if you let people see the kind of statement you really get and what a prosecutor has to do to overcome it, if he has to use it or not. The other thing, of course, are the rules you're talking about that allow in scientific evidence. You don't just get to put on any kind of scientific evidence you want to. It has to pass muster. There are tests for that. You have to usually have a hearing if it's something new in the field. In the very beginning, when DNA was first out, you had to have these enormously long hearings that showed that that the DNA testing methods were accepted in the scientific community, and that was no easy thing to prove. So there are quite a few hoops to jump through before you get to have this stuff come into evidence. It doesn't just come, you know, okay, I'll just call my expert. No, you won't.
Right. So the person who it may be, say, in a show who's discovered some, you know, new way of, you know, I don't know, processing, say, some of the things that really drive me crazy are the photo manipulations that... You know, that someone is doing all this manipulating of a photo, and that's really, the court does not like you to bring in doctored stuff,
right.
You know.
Right. Well, and they won't let you, you know. I mean, the defense will object and say, hey, that's not the original. That's a, you know, and even if it's a blow up, the defense has the right to look at it to determine and make sure that it isn't distorted in some way. So there's you don't just get to do whatever you want, turn it into a hologram. And
yes. Obi-Wan Kenobi, things have changed by then. But or they were back in the day. I guess that was supposed to be before, right?
That's right. It's a prequel. You're talking about the, I got lost.
But in the real world, there are these tests. And so the judge is going to ask you to bring in experts on each side, and I'm assuming also the defense gets to bring in experts saying this might not be so reliable or this isn't accepted yet, right?
Exactly. Both sides call their experts, and the judge then has to make a ruling determining, you know, basically saying it is or is not reliable, it is or is not accepted in the scientific community and meets the standards required for admission into evidence. And that requires testimony from experts, and it's going to be from both sides. It's pretty, you know, towards the end of DNA acceptance, the defense was more and more never mind calling the witness, it's not worth it, it's going to come in. And they would just kind of make a record by cross-examining the prosecution expert. And then you know, we're at the point now where it's all been accepted and it comes in. But there will be new methods of DNA testing that will require the same kind of expert testimony before it's allowed in, I'm sure. I mean, PCR, I don't want to get too far out there, but the PCR testing was relatively new when we were doing Simpson. And that required all kinds of hearings because their argument was you can use it to exclude people, but you can't use it to identify.
Right. I think, you know, this is just actually this week in today's news, we're talking about a case that's actually the third trial of this individual. And they have someone who's an expert at touch DNA. who's apparently testified about 60 times. But that may sound like a lot, but in when you look at the whole country, that's not many trials. And so I think that, again, is that's one of the areas that we're getting into with the DNA is how small an amount is going to serve in all this. And I know there are even questions being raised about, does one individual really have one, you know, kind of DNA, you know, one DNA all the way through? Is that true all the time? Do we really know that? You know, all these kinds of complications. So so I think this is something I think actually a lot of people don't understand about science, and you probably see this, you know, or saw this as well in court, is that the nature of science is that you question what was before taken to be proven. So you can always find yourself, you know, feeling very sure about something in one decade and, you know, a decade or so later, you know, in the FBI lab, as I know, gone through this with gunshot residue and things like that. So hair evidence, you know, bite marks, it's, you know, anything can be challenged. Even once it's in, doesn't mean, I guess they've even, there's been fingerprint challenges.
I mean, they don't get very far with it, because in order to prove that two people have the same fingerprints, and boy, that's a stretch. So, I you know, they have yet to really establish that in any case. And so, and fingerprints have been around so long that if you really had a problem with people having identical fingerprints, this would have come up a lot. You know, we'd be seeing it happen because there is so much testing. The databases are huge. They're vast. And if we're not finding matching fingerprints, you know, people, different people with the same fingerprints coming up, then by now we certainly should have. But DNA, you know, it's a different story. We don't have as big, although it's growing by the minute, the database for DNA profiles. It used to be the biggest challenge was that the databases were too small to justify the conclusion that no two people had exactly the same DNA. I think we're approaching, every day we're approaching more certainty that that's probably true, but the databases are still not nearly as big, I think, as the fingerprint bases.
Right. I mean, well, the fingerprint, as you were saying, I mean, even if you just go to the computerized version of it, I think it's got at least a decade start on CODIS. And if you go to the card system, I have to say I just admire those people who would sit down with, you know, the 10 cards and on a rotor and have the ability to, you know, they were mentally the computers, you know. I was just having a friend talk to me about this, about these people who, you know, and this may seem like a long time ago, but, you know, 40 years ago, there are people who've been on the job during those 40 years, and they were doing all this by hand. So it's amazing.
Incredible. Yeah, incredible. I know.
Yeah. So I think a lot of people have, for better or worse, watched trials on television, and especially I think HLN and True TV and some of the other, you know, Court TV channels that run a lot of trials, and they've probably noticed that there will be experts that contradict each other. So for starters, how do you choose who's, do you get a choice about your forensic expert, or do you have to live with the guy the lab sends over to you?
Usually you have to live with the guy they send to you. You know, LAPD has a crime lab, and whoever was assigned to you is what you get. The only time that you can get, you get to choose outside that box is if either their technician has a problem, can't testify, or you're going to wind up with so much of a big contest, and the case is a heavy-duty case, not necessarily high profile, but, you know, in serious charges like murder, then they may let you find another expert to back up what has already been done. But evidence typically goes straight to LAPD, mm-hmm. especially now that they've got a crime lab with a DNA facility up and running. Back mm-hmm. when I was doing it, we had to use Cellmark for a mm. lot of, yeah, in the very beginning, before Simpson. We had to use Cellmark because LAPD was not set up to do DNA testing. And then because there was such a big challenge in the Simpson case, we wound up sending out our samples to Cellmark as well as Department of Justice. And then at one point, before all of that even, I wanted to agree to let the defense expert, Ed Blake, do all of the testing because I knew he was a good guy. And mm-hmm. we could share all of the results, but the defense did not want to share the results.
Mm.
So,
so we how funny!
That, yeah. So typically, though, yeah, police department has its own, or your jurisdiction has its own place. And I think down in the south part of California, in Riverside, I think they use biotech. They might use a private
mm-hmm.
lab,
mm-hmm.
but their crime lab is not equipped. But you have whatever it is, whether it's a private lab that you always use or one that's associated with the police station, with the police department, you have your own place that it goes. You can reach outside that and get additional experts only in very unusual cases.
Okay. Well, we are going to take a quick break, and we will be back soon to talk more with Marcia Clark about forensic science and the courtroom.
Offering of reason, we put them all in play. A covering of treason, that one by one we let slip away. A solitary cancer, so lost upon her stage.
Welcome back, everybody, to the second half of Crime and Science Radio. Before we get right back to your show, just a couple quick notes. We have some books we want to tell you about first. Abe Lincoln, Public Enemy Number 1 by Brian Anthony and Bill Walker. Check that out at LincolnPublicEnemy.com. Also, Deadlight by Mike Pace. Check out MikePaceBooks.com. Cloud Lover by Ron Turpling, that Brad Thor called a fabulous writer. You can check that out at Ron Turpening. TERPENING.com. In the Bleak Midwinter by M.R. Sellers at MRSellers.com. Baden Powell Beads London with Paul Parsons. Check out PaulDParsons.com for more information. Also, Strong Rain Falling by John Land. And that's the new Caitlin Strong book. Check out JohnLandBooks.com. And finally, The Omega Project by Steve Alton. And you can check all that out at SteveAlton.com. And now, back to the second half of the show, and here's your host, Jan Burke.
Thank you, John, and welcome back. Talking here today with Marcia Clark. So, Marcia, during the break, John raised a question that I thought was a good one, and maybe we could talk about it just a little bit, is what we see defendants in courtroom dramas. This is another thing I suppose that is unusual, is they are quite often these very suave and well-behaved people in suits, or they are beautiful, you know, women who, you know, underneath it all are cold-hearted or whatever, but they are not... they're not people that may, let's say, represent the average bear who's brought to trial. So tell us a little more about, in your experience, about the, we'll just say, the criminal mind and the criminal demeanor and what kinds of people you've seen come before you. And I'm sure there's a range, but just maybe a glimpse at a few of those types of personalities.
Well, yeah, the ones, I love that they always have the types that they're very cool and they're very collected and they're even charming. Now, it's not to say that that kind of defendant doesn't happen. It does happen, but it's rare. That kind of defendant is typically a sociopath. They are, you know, they tend to be the, not necessarily serial killers, but they commit the crimes for pleasure, for fun, for profit too. But it's a specific type of defendant, and that kind of defendant is more in control of his instrument than your typical defendants. The typical defendant is, you know, Johnny tells Eddie, hey, man, let's go rob that liquor store, and they grab somebody's gun and go do it, and, you know, boom, and then they mess it up, and they get hooked up immediately because they're idiots, and they wind up in court. So typical of most defendants is that among the many issues they have is poor impulse control. And so that poor impulse control frequently finds its way out into the courtroom. And so they'll give hard looks to witnesses, and they'll pop off and say things in front of the jury. They'll argue with their lawyers. They'll do all kinds of things that are very, very bad for them. And, they just don't have that great of control. They're not that, you know, they're not the suave, debonair type you see in your courtroom dramas.
Right. I mean, we understand that in a book you've got to create a worthy antagonist, so it's not much of a story to say, hey, Bob, let's go out and rob the liquor store.
You know what, Jan? I get into this with people all the time. They say to me, so are these like all the cases you handled? Like, they, I said, if I told you that story, this book would be over in 2 pages. he went to rob a liquor store. Boom, end of story.
Now, if there's something behind that, that's another case. But,
yeah.
you know. Yeah. So this sort of brings me, I think, makes a nice segue to something else I want to talk to you about, which is confusion about terms. People hear words that have legal meaning, and I would also recommend for our listeners who are writers a good legal dictionary. You know, they make some that are not overly complicated, that are sort of designed for the layperson to understand better, but that can be helpful to you when you're writing. So that, for example, I see a lot of confusion between homicide and murder. And so I don't think people always understand the difference between, say, homicide and murder and the difference between, say, murder and manslaughter. So can
right.
you talk about that for a starter?
Sure. And that is a really common one. Homicide means that you have a criminal agency killing. That means somebody died at the hands of another. But what they did, whether it's first degree, second degree, or manslaughter, is a whole separate issue. So homicide simply means there's a criminal agency involved in the death of a party.
Right. Someone's dead who shouldn't have been dead.
I'm sorry?
Someone's dead who shouldn't have been dead.
Yeah. Someone's dead. Yeah, and he didn't get there naturally.
Mm-hmm.
And it's at the hands of another, because otherwise it's termed a suicide.
Okay.
So that's it. Homicide is death at the hands of another. There's an indication of criminal agency. So then you get to, okay, homicide happened. So what kind of crime was committed? That's a separate issue. The kind of crime that was committed takes you down the path of, was it murder? The first degree murder is your premeditated murder. That's the murder where there is some degree of planning. As the jury instruction tells you, and this is, I think, nationwide, planning does not require any particular length of time. If I pick up a gun, look at you, and say, you know what, I'm going to shoot you, that's premeditated murder. And that's all
point.
It takes.
Just yeah.
in that one breath of time, that's enough. Doesn't require any particular measure of time for premeditation. But it is an intentional killing. Then you have second-degree murder. Second-degree murder can be what they call rash impulse. In other words, the kind of murder that occurs in the course of a fight or an argument. That's where it's a murder basically that is not premeditated. Then you have manslaughter. Voluntary manslaughter is a killing in which there is some kind of mitigating influence. By that I mean something that makes it less than murder. For example, we're all familiar with heat of passion. If you are in the course of a bar fight and somebody throws a bottle at you and you swing a bottle at him and hit him in the head and kill him, that's most likely to be a manslaughter. Might be an involuntary manslaughter or a voluntary manslaughter, but it's manslaughter.
Mm-hmm.
The other way you get to manslaughter is if you believe, even though unreasonably believe, that you need to defend yourself. That brings us into the George Zimmerman case. So the theory behind this form of manslaughter is that somebody's threatening you, and you honestly believe that you need to defend yourself with lethal force, but you don't. It's not a reasonable belief. The belief is not reasonable. You don't really have a full justification for believing you need to use lethal force. That also, it's called unreasonable belief in the need for self-defense. That, too, can give you a manslaughter. Now, if you reasonably believe that you need to use lethal force in self-defense, then it's a complete excuse. Then you're not guilty of anything.
So in all of these cases, let's say outside of something like this special unit that you were part of, the special trials unit, where you're really there from the beginning, in other cases, who is going to look at the evidence? Well, I guess you would actually still do this even in special trials, where you would look at what you have and decide what's a reasonable set of charges.
Oh, yeah,
bring.
Absolutely. Yeah, the decision on what to file, that's also something that is unusual, that is specific to a special unit. The ordinary cases go through a division that is set up. It's called the Complaints Division downtown, and they are set up, or in branch courts they call filing deputies, and all they do is they talk to the cops, bring in their police reports, and say, I want to file charges on Joe Smith. And then the filing deputy will look at the reports and decide what they have there and decide what charges to file. When you're in a special unit, particularly special trials, the detectives come straight to me. And they say, this is what we've got on Joe Smith. We think that he's good for a murder. I review the reports and I decide whether or not I agree and then file whatever charges I see.
Mm-hmm. Now, so this, I'm assuming, can also lead to some tension between the police and the... Well, I've heard it from them. You know, because they're going to think they've got a case every time.
I mean, not all of them. You know, some are really, really reasonable. They come in, they know, hey, you know, it might be a little skinny now, but, you know, at least review it, tell me what you think I'm missing, and let's talk about it. And frequently in those situations, I'll do what we call a reject pending. And that means I reject the case pending further investigation. So that means it's not really rejected. It's just saying, go out and do some more stuff. And that usually, if you're working with police officers who are reasonable, if you're being reasonable, then everybody's fine with that. That doesn't always happen, though. There are these occasions when, yes, you have somebody come in who's hard, who's chomping at the bit and snorting fire out of his nose, and, you know, and I've got this guy, and he's got, this is good for murder, and he's going to be blah, 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 and you have to file this. And I have gotten into it on one or two occasions. And on one occasion, they went over my head, went to the big honcho and said, we think we've got it, and she's wrong. And they backed me, but...
Well, that's always good when that happens at work, wherever you're working.
Yeah. No, it was, you know, needless to say, that was a very uncomfortable time, and there was a lot of tension and a lot of anger because, you know, they come in believing in their case, which, you know, they should. If they're going to bring in a case, unless they're coming in to say, hey, I just need to show that I'm working with a DA on this and I'm working it up, give me a reject pending, and they're okay with it. I mean, that's different. But if they really believe there's a filing, they ought to be, you know. They ought to be behind their own case. But that's why you need to have checks and balances. You can't just have one person making all the decisions, and that's why it's good to have a prosecutor sitting on the outside and saying, hey, you know, if I take this to trial, the defense is going to say X, Y, and Z. You know, you're missing your witness, your eyewitness isn't that strong, and he's a gangbanger from the rival gang, from the defendant. He'll say anything to nail your defendant, you know, that kind of thing. So we need more. So go find me corroboration.
Right. So to kind of go back to some of the terms, what in a court of law does the phrase, and this may sound like I'm going afield from forensic science, but I actually think this has so much to do with what's happening with juries and forensic science right now, and that's the term reasonable doubt. Because I think we're kind of reaching a point where people believe anything can be proven with physical evidence, that it's always available and there's always some way to test it. And if you're not bringing it in, you just didn't really look for it.
You know, right. You're so right. It's a big problem. You have these cases that get highly publicized where there's this ton of evidence. There's hair, there's fiber, there's blood, there's DNA, there's saliva, there's everything you could imagine. You have it all. That's cool, but that's not common. You know, first of all, not all crimes lend themselves. You know, a burglary very seldom leaves you much more than fingerprints. You're lucky if you get fingerprints, incredibly lucky. And usually you're relying on something like an eyewitness down the street who got a glimpse of somebody, and good luck with that one. So, and juries have this skewed view of cases, and they believe that, you know, that we should always have DNA and always have all this, a wealth of physical evidence. And maybe someday we will. Maybe someday evidence collection will reach the point where we'll be able to get electrostatic footprints out of dust and, you know, all that cool stuff. But we're not there, and most cases don't provide that. And so as a result, juries can wind up equating lack of physical evidence with reasonable doubt. But here's the thing, Jan. I handle criminal appeals now across the state of California from, you know, the northern tip to the southern tip. So I have a better chance now to see an overall view of what juries are doing than I ever did before. And I see them convicting without physical evidence all the time. what tends to, you know, in any given case, juries may come in and decide they like a defendant, you know, more than they like the prosecution, more than they like the victim. These things can happen. And I just handled the case. It was really interesting. They charged the three defendants with murder. The three defendants came off better than the victims did. And the jury acquitted two and convicted the third of manslaughter. Ordinarily, a case like that, you know, where the victim's unarmed, the defendant is the one who went and got the weapon, you'd have murder convictions across the board. But they just didn't, they did not cotton to the victims and his friends, and it went the other way. That wasn't about physical evidence or the lack of it. That was a whole different feeling that they had about the people. And that's why reasonable doubt always makes me, oh, God, because it's a very elastic term. And the problem is that a jury can say reasonable doubt when they're really, objectively speaking, isn't. And then what they do is they convert reasonable doubt to reason to doubt.
Mm-hmm.
If we find a reason to doubt that the sun is going to rise tomorrow, you know, there's going to be an apocalypse tonight, Jen, and that's it. The sun's going to explode. No sunrise tomorrow.
Yeah.
That's a reason. It's a reason to doubt. Is it reasonable? No, it's not reasonable. But that's what happens with the juries. And I think that's why sometimes you wind up with these weird verdicts, and they come out saying there's a reasonable doubt, and everybody else watching it says, there was no reasonable doubt. Well, you're right. It wasn't reasonable, but they found a reason to doubt.
Yeah. It's I've been a juror in cases where people are trying to bring in stuff that wasn't presented in the trial, and, you know, and I'm such a spoil sport because I'll say, you know, the judge's instructions, they don't like that person on the jury.
Yeah.
You know, they don't like the rule person.
Right.
Why don't we follow the judge's rules? They don't like that person. I have to admit, that's not a popular position.
Oh, I can imagine that it's pissed off.
Yeah,
they want to go off on tangents. I've never been on a jury. I don't know. I've heard from my friends that it's kind of a scary experience.
I will just say that my cynicism level goes way up every time I do it. But anyway, so circumstantial evidence, what does that phrase mean?
Circumstantial evidence is evidence from which you, here I go into my law school stuff, you know, evidence from which you must draw an inference in order to conclude that a defendant is guilty. Okay, so what does that gobbledygook mean? A fingerprint is circumstantial evidence. Why? Because you have to deduce from the fingerprint that the person who left the print is the one who committed the crime. You don't directly see him do it. That's direct evidence. So that's the short version of it.
Right, which means that most evidence then is circumstantial.
Physical evidence, when you come to scientific evidence, it's all circumstantial. DNA is circumstantial. Everything short of a defendant saying, I did it, or an eyewitness pointing and saying, he did it, is circumstantial.
Which is kind of remarkable when you realize what we're learning about eyewitness testimony. But yes. So here's another one that I think people really don't understand. Legally insane.
Oh, yes. So here's the thing. There is it's a very high standard to prove that someone is legally insane. You have to prove that they did not understand the nature and quality of their act, and that they and could not control their behavior. But basically, that they did not know what they were doing. So you're talking about somebody who goes into a bar and shoots three people, but honestly believes that he has just sprayed flowers with insecticide. You know what I mean? It's that level of disorientation or lack of reality in what he's doing. And very, very few criminals can meet that test. Very rare. So legally insane really does mean somebody who doesn't appreciate the nature and quality of his act. So,
right. So
who's
when
that?
You're sitting
who does that even fit? Okay.
Right. So when you're sitting at home and you're saying, well, you'd have to be a little crazy to want to take somebody else's life, that's not the standard.
That's not the standard. See, I mean, if it were, then, you know, you'd have everybody legally insane because they're really, what sane, rational person, you know, decides that you have to go kill somebody? Doesn't matter what they've done to you. Do you really have to kill the person? You know, and it, you, there, we used to have a test in California a long time ago called irresistible impulse. And that was where they said, you know, if a guy, if a defendant had an irresistible impulse, could not control himself from committing the crime, then he was legally insane. Well, the problem with that test, you can see it like right away as I'm saying it. Really? Is it an irresistible impulse, or is it an impulse you simply did not resist? Okay. Isn't that all crime? Isn't that every single crime, an impulse you didn't resist? Okay.
Yes. I'm waiting for the day when actually neuroscience brings us to a whole new understanding of how the, and we're already starting to see some of it, where we're learning more about how their brains actually work differently often from other people's brains. Not all of them, but some of them. And
the psychopath certainly does. They have done, they're doing some really interesting testing now with the psychopaths and showing actually the empathy center in the brain is inactive. I mean, there's really physical differences that you can see.
Right. And they physically respond differently to violent images than even other people who are convicted of violent crimes.
Yes. What people seldom appreciate is that the psychopath is a 2 to 5% of the population, very, very small, and you'd even call it statistically insignificant. The vast majority of criminals are not that. They're not sociopaths. They're messed up. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that this is a picture of mental health. But
yes.
there are other issues.
Yes. Okay. Well, I've got a couple more on my list here. One was hearsay evidence. I think people really don't understand that one.
You know what? Lawyers a lot of times don't understand it. Hearsay requires its own study. Believe it or not, what hearsay is simply defined as a statement made out of court. So hearsay then can be something, even if you're on the witness stand and you want to testify to something you said to somebody during a crime, that can be hearsay. So, I mean, it's not just a statement. Sorry about that. I already have to correct myself. A statement made out of court offered for the truth of the matter asserted. That's really important. Because if you're not offering a statement to prove what you're saying is true, then it's not hearsay. It might be other things that keep it out, but it's not hearsay. For example, a question. If you ask me, Marcia, what are you doing? That's not hearsay. That is a question. What truth are you asserting? There's nothing you're proving with that question. There is no truth. It might do other things, but what it is not is hearsay. So it's an out-of-court statement offered for the truth of the matter. And generally speaking, we do have a lot of exceptions to it. I think that's where a lot of the confusion comes in. Because, for example, if I'm the prosecutor and a defendant made a statement during the crime, lay down or I'll shoot you in the head, I'm allowed to put his statement on. It is hearsay. The witness is going to say, he said blah, 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 blah. And you're going to say, wait, that's hearsay. What the defendant said to the witness is hearsay. How can the witness testify to it? He can because it's a party admission. And under Section 1220 of the Evidence Code, that comes in if the prosecution is proving it. The defendant cannot do that. If he wants to put in his own statement, he has to take the stand and find a way to put it in. But he can't elicit his own hearsay. Only the prosecution can do it. So it gets really complicated because you have all these exceptions, and I can do it, but he can't, and then that kind of thing. It gets gnarly, and that's why there's a lot of arguments about hearsay.
Right. So when you sometimes something is going on in court, it may actually be allowed in. It's not just where every time someone speaks about something somebody said outside of court.
Exactly. There's no hard and fast rule when it comes to the hearsay rule.
Right.
Great. Thank you very much, Marcia. Shut up.
No. I mean, I think this is important because, I mean, the law gets changed by precedent and, you know, in our system, it's not just, you know, there's interpretation that goes on and it builds and builds and builds over time and things change. So, you know, you can't just... if it were simple, you know, Yes. I don't want to think about what would happen, actually.
Yeah, let's not go there.
Yeah. So another thing, and I want to do this real quick because I do want to talk about Rachel Knight and what's going on with her next, but just very quickly, because we mentioned this once when we were on it together on another show with Chris Rice, about plea bargains, that people don't often understand why attorneys go for plea bargains rather than trials. And as taxpayers, they should understand it, if no other way. But
yeah.
Maybe explain a little bit about why plea bargains are so necessary to the system.
Well, I think if we didn't have plea bargains, the system would collapse, because there's just no possible way to have the resources to take every single case to trial, thousands upon thousands of cases. You know, I can't even – it boggles the mind if you realize how many cases are in the system just in L.A. County alone. Now, the defendants want a plea bargain because it limits their exposure. If they go to trial, they face the maximum sentence possible for all of the charges that they get convicted of. And if that amounts to something like 99 years to life, and the prosecutor says, hey, you know what, I'll give you 25 to life, yeah, he's going to save himself the grief of going to trial and risking what we call the 12-headed monster, convicting him of everything.
So do tell us about Rachel Knight and what's next, and maybe a little bit about because Killer Ambition is quite another step for her. I'll say she's really explore something. You really explore some things with her in this book that you know. I see the groundwork in the previous two, but maybe talk a little bit about that.
Well, in Killer Ambition, Rachel picks up a case that begins with the abduction of the daughter of a megastar director like Steven Spielberg or James Cameron, that level of director. And she and Bailey go out to the scene, find that the father has already, the director has already paid a $1 million ransom. And then things devolve from there into murders and a long-buried Hollywood secret. In this case, Rachel actually not only does the investigation with Bailey, Detective Bailey Keller, but they take the case to trial. And it's a big, hot media spotlight case, of course, because it involves the megastar director and a lot of highly placed, high-profile Hollywood celebs. And I show what it's like to live through the prosecution of a media case and a lot of the strategy involved in jury selection, in the way you prepare for your witnesses, how you call your witnesses in what order, and then having basically just take you through what a lawyer does in a high-profile case, and dealing with the defense attorney, dealing with the tabloids and all the reporters and a lot of the insanity, as well as the roller coaster that a jury trial really is, the ups and downs, the witness, you know, goes south on you unexpectedly, and in this case, in Killer Ambition, a key witness for the prosecution goes belly up, so to speak, and almost tanks the entire case. In fact, does tank the entire case. So that one is has a lot of forensics in it. The one I'm just finishing now, The Competition, is actually a study of the Eric Harris, Dylan Klebold, Columbine kind of thing, where you have high school shooters, and I get into. It's really a study. It's an action novel. I don't want to misrepresent it, but there is a lot of discussion of what makes guys like these tick. How do these psychopaths occur, and you know, what can be done, and how do the parents think? And so there are actually shrinks involved in this book who assist Rachel and Bailey in tracking down the killers and figuring out their mindset.
So let me just say to everyone here that you can hear – actually, Marcia talk more about Killer Ambition, the current book, on suspensemagazine.com. We want you to check out our website for Crime and Science Radio, because Marcia and I will be putting up some links that will be helpful to you as well. And thank you very much, Marcia.
Thank you so much, Dan. What a pleasure.
Thanks.